Welcome to HQ AF Radio. My name's Francis. And you're listening to a show about two best friends. Today we've got a very special guest on the show, my sister Donica.
Hey!
I think the last time you were on the show was, when were you back here?
Last year, before I went back to school, yeah.
Now Donica's back
from school. But it was three of us, right?
Was it three of us?
Yeah, I think it may have been all three of us.
I don't know. I'd ask Alana, the super fan of our own show, to to reference.
Reference the archives.
Yeah, but so it's been a while. Donica was in school last... Oh, no, you know what? Now that we're talking about it, it was Munich.
We recorded one in Munich as well? Yes.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, that's true.
And so that was back in May, six months ago. Yeah. You were still in school. You're about to finish up school, actually. And now Donica's finished.
Yay! Master of Science.
She's got her master's. She is a master of science.
Ooh.
Do you think,
so wise. So,
but you also are a bachelor of science.
I am. The only true bachelor of science.
What does a PhD stand for?
Philosophy doctorate. Doctor of philosophy. Yes. Huh. I start getting into the philosophical realm, like, oh, where's my beard?
One might argue that master's is philosophical, as are bachelor's. One might argue all of higher education is philosophical.
Oh, I thought we were talking actual master's, like,
what? I don't know. We've gone off the rails with this conversation. But Donica's graduated.
Yay!
She defended her thesis.
If anyone has a job in engineering, needs an engineer, hi!
And,
find me on LinkedIn.
And yeah, something in the city, preferably, with a nice stipend.
Some robots.
Yeah, some robots. So she's back. She's staying with us for a while. She and I actually have travel plans. I guess together, sort of together, we're going to see family.
Together, but not together.
Yeah, we're going to go see family in Thanksgiving, for Thanksgiving, but we're traveling independently of each other, but then also meeting up and traveling together. It's kind of a weird situation.
It's like I-95 and Route 1. Sometimes there are places where they connect, other times they don't.
Yeah, so... interesting times. I'm sure we'll have another podcast where we talk about our interesting times.
With Alex.
Oh my gosh.
Because I don't... when was the last time she did it then?
Oh, yeah. Last year, I think.
Last year. Yeah. Suffering through Korean school.
Right. So this is... we're just recording right now the week before Thanksgiving. Next week is when we're traveling. So wanted to talk about some... family matters. Not really family, it's more financial matters. I'm sure you haven't listened to the episode where Alana and I actually talk about finances. We talk about personal finance.
Oh, so this is like continuation.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a series. We're starting a series where we're talking to like other people about it now, because you know, one of the things that we found, or that I find in my own personal life, is that it's hard for people to talk about finances, right? Yeah. Like if you think about just a group of people, or yeah, any group of people, rather. There's a lot of taboo subjects.
You don't want to say how much you make. You don't want to say how you've invested in things, or you know, like how much debt you have.
Exactly.
Unless it's about student loan debt. I do feel like there are so many news articles out now with people who are like, I paid off this much, or I still have this much.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I referenced in an earlier episode, DesX and Money had a really good two-part series on student loans.
I thought you were going to go Planet Money, because that's like the other really big financial...
Yeah. No, this one was like how people felt about their student loans and how it's kind of interwoven in their lives. And it was a really good episode for those of you who are paying off student loans and kind of feeling the burn. Like, I really recommend listening to it. So wanted to, you know, bring in other people and start talking about that and seeing what your experience with it has been. And I think, you know, with you and I having sort of the same background, maybe you'll relate to this more, but I feel like I didn't have a foundation really starting my adult life with financial education. And I don't like necessarily blame our parents. Like, I think they did teach me enough to know what a savings account is. And
like balance the checkbook maybe as well. Because I do remember learning something about the checkbook.
That is like antiquated. I'd never do that nowadays. Apparently, I've never done it. But also just like, one thing I think I remember very distinctly is my dad saying, or our dad saying, oh, you always have to pay off the balance on a credit card loan.
Yes, always pay it off. Don't let it go to the next month.
Those are probably the two things I've taken away from...
from them.
Yeah, my parents. Like, and, you know, to be fair, it's a lot. Like, I don't necessarily blame them. The personal finance, like, now that I'm delving deep into what all those principles are, it's a lot. It's a lot to kind of do. And they are immigrants, you know, like, coming from a country where I don't think people really
It's not, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, now that I'm kind of coming into adult life on my own, like, talking to Chris about our own finances as a couple,
mm-hmm.
you know, and trying to strategize for the future, now I'm realizing, wow, this is a lot. This is a lot to kind of get into. Yeah, so how do you feel, like, from that standpoint, how do you feel coming into adult life? How prepared were you?
So I think originally that was, like, I want to say my adult life started in, like, just prior to Philadelphia, because I was always really good about saving up until I moved to New York.
Yeah.
Right? I was always really good about putting a little bit away, making sure I paid off the credit cards, living on a budget.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's maybe something I learned in school, because I feel like at home ec, they do teach you a little bit. But as far as I know, it's not...
It's like
a dying thing in the U.S.
I have never actually, yeah, so I took home ec maybe when I was in middle school.
Yeah, I feel like all 3 years of middle school, it was required for at least like a month, and that's it.
Yeah.
Or 3 months.
Yeah.
But, so I feel like I knew that kind of stuff, but actually I do have to say, it's very, remember that time I almost joined a cult?
Yes, I do remember you joining a cult.
I did not fully join this cult.
But this was back when you were living in San Francisco. But why don't we just go through the story for our listeners?
Okay, I mean, what I learned or like the actual story?
Well, I guess when you like start with that, you have to go through the whole story.
Okay.
So just maybe the abridged version.
I was living in Palo Alto, and I have just a tendency, as always, to sit in cafes, coffee shops, do work.
Yeah.
Right? Especially in the evenings after work, I'll write, I'll apply for other jobs, I'll do whatever I need to do, homework or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was so in a cafe, Palo Alto, like, across the street from Stanford, that kind of thing, and this girl compliments me on my shoes, and this is the beginning of, like, this, like, weird thing, right?
Right.
Because, you know, as in here, it's also very common to open with, so what do you do?
Oh, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that area, yeah.
That's something you want to know early about a person.
Yeah.
And, you know, at times it can feel disingenuous.
Yeah.
Right, kind of like, hey, are you important enough to know? Should I add you to my network?
Really?
That kind of,
Sometimes I feel like it's a conversation starter. Like,
sometimes,
people don't know what else to do.
And so I think here it feels kind of networky. In California, maybe it can be a conversation starter because there are some people who are doing really interesting things.
Yeah.
Here it's kind of like, okay, you work for the government, you work for this agency. Who do you know?
Maybe just like too awkward to not think anything else.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah, And like, to be fair, it takes up, like, 40 hours of your week. That's a significant portion of your life.
Yeah.
But this girl, I mean, she asked me, and then I ask her, and she evades the question. Hmm. And, you know, she's very dodgy about answering. She's like, you know, I brought this company from, like, this much to this much, which, to me, you know, like, not really from that area, it sounds like a lot. To my roommates who were born and raised in that part of California, and, you know, they've always been exposed to this, they're like, okay, that's not really that impressive.
Oh,
right. Huh. To me, it sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
Mind you, this is a conversation because I complimented her shoes, and she was telling me, you know, I had these mentors who taught me about it. You know, they were in their 30s, and they retired, and they just live off of, like, the money that they made from doing whatever.
Yeah.
They can show you how. But I had to work really hard for this mentorship. But I'm willing to refer you. Like, I'm willing. You seem like a cool girl, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, you seem like you have the right mindset. And I was initially very, like, hesitant, because, I mean, come on, man. I came of age in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You don't refer people that you've just met.
Yeah.
You know, because, and she actually put it really well, your credibility is my credibility.
Hmm.
Right? So if she refers me and I don't do so well, it looks really bad on her.
Exactly. It's like me referring somebody to a job and they, like, suck at the job. Then it reflects poorly on me.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So I was really curious because, one, she's telling me, okay, these people retired at the age of 30.
Right.
And they have their kid and they do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And then two, okay, you're willing to refer me to these people, and you just met me. You sat for like 15 minutes to talk to me. This is like a huge red flag.
Yeah.
So it's like these two very like positive, negative, right? End up going with her, meeting with one of her mentors, and, you know, attending several just one-on-one meetings with these two.
Yeah.
And then actually going to a bigger meeting in their apartment.
Yeah.
Before I finally was just like, okay, this is dumb. Goodbye. Like,
yeah.
Dumb for personal safety reasons.
Right.
Goodbye.
Yeah, because they were, like, refresh my memory, but they're starting to get a little aggressive, and they've started wanting things from you.
Yeah, so, I mean, by things, you know, like, they assigned me homework, like, read this book.
Right.
This very poorly written book. Like, I get the meaning.
That they had written.
Yeah, like, written in their organization, and I was just like, okay, that's weird. But, you know, I think especially after meeting this girl, the places where they would ask me to go were always further and further out, and they would see me, like, I have this bicycle helmet. I have a bike. Like,
yeah.
I don't have a car in this area, and they'd want me to go across the bay. They'd want me to go two cities over, you know? And it basically got to the point where, you know, they're over. Well, I guess. Okay, so I need to talk about the finance issue of this, right?
Yeah.
The reason why I kept going back is because she presented a very, very compelling case. But that's kind of how cults work, right? Like, they get you by sounding normal.
Right.
And then they bring out the crazy, and then...
Yeah, then they're appealing to, like, a hardship that you're kind of going through. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think maybe a part of it is also because I was alone, because I'm young.
Yeah.
You know, I think especially millennials and people in California, Palo Alto, are very much into this get-rich-quick kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? But they really enlightened me, and I think that they're actually correct about this. A lot of what we know and we learn when we grow up is that, you know, you work hard for 40 hours a week for 40, 50 years of your life to save up retirement money, and then you retire and you try to live off of that.
Right.
I think that this is something that many people around in the U.S. and in other parts of the world, this is their model of their financial, I don't know, like, their financial life.
Yeah.
Right? And basically, she makes a very good point. If you stop working, you have no money.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so the analogy she used was always to carry a bucket. You know, every day you need to carry a bucket to get water that you need to live, to cook, to clean your things, whatever. If you stop carrying the bucket, then there's no water.
Right.
But what if there's a way to have water without always having to carry the bucket?
What if you could make it rain?
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
If
you don't have to go to the well. And she pointed out, also very true, that, you know, like, a lot of the people who are really pushing this model of, you know, carrying the bucket are people like our parents, our friends, our family. This is true, right? This is the model that our parents also...
Sure.
Right?
I mean, yeah, I don't disagree.
And she's just like, now, are any of those people rich? No. I mean, technically... I mean, depends on how we look at wealth, but if we're talking about, like...
Somebody that can, like, make it rain?
Yeah, like, no. Mark Zuckerberg, I don't have to worry about work kind of rich? No, they're not. And she's just like, and she goes, so why would you take advice from people who do not... who are not, you know, they haven't achieved that goal that you're trying to achieve.
Okay. I mean, so far, so good.
Like, so far, so
like,
good.
Everything is making some sense.
Exactly. Now, the problem, so the only problem really, because a lot of the things she said made sense, the big problem was she would say these things and she's like, you know, I can reveal to you the secrets. Right? But they're going to sound outlandish. They're going to sound weird to all of your friends and family. People who do not have any real investment or stake in this because they're not currently where you want to be, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you either, one, you shouldn't tell them, you shouldn't actively talk to them about the things that I'm going to say to you, I don't want you to repeat to them. Yeah, basically very isolating tactics. I'm like, well, this is really the beginnings of a cult.
Yeah, no, essentially. Did you ever find out the secret before you left?
So I found...
What are the secrets? Can you tell us on this podcast?
Okay. So I think that the easiest way to start with, to get you wet, to wet your toes. To wet your toes.
I'm wet already. I'm so wet. I'm drizzled on.
So, to wet your toes, she pointed out that a lot of the wealthiest people in the world, like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, they don't actually have to work for that wealth. Right now, most of the income that they get are actually from other sources of are from other sources than their 9-to-5 job. They're in things like index funds, royalties, appearances. They have other sources of income.
Sure, but I mean, all the people that you've just kind of listed also started like companies and have. They've actually like built. They've built their wealth.
I mean, that's the thing, right? I think it's not like. I don't think anything she could have told me. I don't know if I ever truly stumbled upon their secrets. I don't know how far I needed to go to stumble upon this.
I want to hear something that I would have been, Donica, this is outlandish.
How? Why? Well, I mean, but that's one thing that she taught me, which is true. I think my roommates kind of already knew this, having grown up in that area, that you need to establish other forms of income.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. Like a side hustle.
Exactly. Right. Like, actually, one of my roommates, who's actually Canadian, he's a financial consultant.
Yeah.
And his dream is to own a trailer park.
Interesting.
Yes, because you just own the land. So his thing is, if you own, for instance, like you're maybe going to put your condo up for rent.
Yeah.
You need to be a landlord.
Right.
You need to, you know, if something breaks down, you need to be there and you need to be open and responsive. If you own a trailer park, especially one that's already established and for some reason the owner wants to give it to you, you just own the land.
Hmm.
So any of the hookups or whatever, the tenants will deal with. They just pay rent to you to have their little trailer in your land.
Yeah, interesting.
So to him, that was his perfect gig was to be...
Yeah.
That was his perfect side hustle.
Right.
Right?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's like this idea, you have to have this... You need to build other streams of income, which to me was... It made sense, and it was revolutionary to hear because no one ever says this. When you're growing up, like this isn't
right,
really
because that is not a model that the baby boomers have come up with.
No,
yeah, it's not. It's something that's very millennial.
It is. In a way. Well, I mean, we say this, but a lot of old money families, a lot of people who are rich now, they establish other forms of income. Maybe they're not
establishing purposeful. I think establishing is the wrong word. It's not a side hustle. It's they're investing.
They're investing
in other. Forms of income
generation.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not necessarily starting up like a new business. Like when you start up a trailer park, that's a new business.
Yeah,
you're kind of undertaking in a new endeavor. But when like a lot of what I hear is like invest in this stock, it returns a lot of dividends, and you can live off of the dividends once you put enough money in that stock.
Right.
Right. Like you're just putting your extra money into something else that will give you even more money.
Exactly.
Which is like the form of super passive income, but with like setting up a trailer park, it is passive income in a way. Starting a new endeavor, though. Like you are actively going and creating this,
right? But I mean, it's the idea that you should go and create these things that require very little maintenance.
Correct.
And that's something that's not generally taught to us in schools. I think
no.
I think the school system is really built. To making workers, you know, it's built to producing people who will work from 9 to 5 for 40 hours a week and not question if there's something else. But the thing is, a lot of people do. Warren Buffett, I'm sure, still has a 9 to 5, right? The Rothschild great-great-grandchildren, whatever, they probably still have a 9 to 5, right? But none of the none of them will be broke if they decide to go to like the Maldives for a week.
Right.
And do nothing.
Right.
You know, because they have other forms of income coming in.
Right.
And this isn't something that's taught to us. It's not something that's, I mean, you can see it, I'm sure. Like, it's not hard to find, but it's just not the cultural model that we grow up with.
Because I think that once you get to that, you get to what's, I think, is sort of like Finance 202.
Yeah.
Right? You have to first set the foundations of the 9 to 5, get the 9 to 5.
Exactly.
Learn how to manage the money that you're getting from that.
And then
start working towards that other
towards piece. Building other things. Exactly. Right.
Which right. is like,
I mean, you have
yeah.
to survive.
Which you first. Don't like, which, yeah, to your point, I don't even think people get taught the finance 101.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think is the issue personally is like
with a lot of
when you go up from K all the way to like
high school,
college,
yeah.
master's, PhD, like when you're in this system, you don't really learn that.
No.
There's no avenue to learn that. It's not forced upon you. You can choose to forgo it if it is. Like, it's yeah. just an elective. And so how am I supposed to know, unless my parents teach me this, that or. I'm supposed to pay off a credit card every single month and, like, not carry over debt when I can?
Well, it's kind of funny, right? Because I think a lot of people, you know, when they make this joke about, oh, we're not taught this, they say, oh, but you're definitely going to need to know how to, like, I don't know, how to integrate whatever, right? If you,
oh, like,
you know,
integrals.
Calculus or
right,
something
right, right.
like that, right?
Yeah.
But just from a cultural standpoint, I think almost every American is taught how to drive.
Right?
And in many places, like I know in Orange, it was free.
Driving class?
Right,
yeah,
right.
It was
part
of your
PE,
elective. Yeah, yeah.
Right? And everyone took it if you're of the right age. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, everyone learns how to drive. And we just accept that that's part of our culture.
Right.
In the Netherlands, you pay 1,000, like a, I think it's at least 1,000 euros.
Right.
In order just to go to the driver school, which you have to do in order to get the license.
Hmm.
So it's kind of weird that we choose to teach this one life skill, but not
how many people in the Netherlands know how to drive then, by your estimation?
I have no idea. I couldn't say. Because
I know the Netherlands is very bike heavy.
It is. So yeah. they always say that there's something like at least 3 or 4 bikes, something like that, for every person in the Netherlands.
Interesting.
I mean, people do have cars.
Yeah, I mean, if you live in, like, if you don't live in Amsterdam or anywhere, like, something, like, very rural, I don't know where the most rural place in Netherlands is.
But there are so many train stations.
Yeah, but even to get from, like, maybe you live in the very boondoggles of wherever the Netherlands, mm-hmm. like, you would still need a car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think my Dutch roommate, I think he said to me that his family between, I think he has a 4-person family, they have 1 car.
Okay.
Even though, you know, like, he was saying, oh, my mom bikes for kilometers and kilometers. And I was just, what? He was very surprised to hear that every person in our family has a car, including myself, even though I'm not currently there.
Right.
But we just kind of accept.
Right.
I mean, the distances are greater. We don't have the same kind of transportation.
I mean, Netherlands versus the U.S.
Yeah.
is gigantic.
You know,
I'm not going to be able to bike back to my parents.
Exactly.
That makes no sense. Public transit is very limited. Like, if you take a city like D.C., D.C. was not built around this transit system.
No.
And so to get anywhere that is not metro accessible, you will need to drive.
Exactly.
I mean, you can try to take the bus, but then it's not as easy. It's still not accessible.
No. I think even in other places, so for instance, I have a German friend. I met him, obviously, in the Netherlands, where he would always bike around. He's doing a PhD now in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me about, oh, you know, I want to move into a place that's maybe a bit more accessible as far as the train system goes, right?
Right.
And, you know, if you're in Manhattan, if you're on, like, the river sides of Long Island, then it's fine. But if you're really deeper in Brooklyn, deeper in Queens, there's not really a ton. You kind of need to drive.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, he's telling me about, oh, transportation desert. I'm like, why don't you just take a bicycle? And he's just like, wait, what? It's like, yeah, you can bike in New York. I would bike all the time.
Yeah.
And so this person who's European, who had just come from a biking country, just the thought of biking in the U.S. was foreign to him.
I think even still Americans in these cities think biking is a foreign thing.
Yeah.
And you know what, like, and like trying to tie it back to finance, I love the public transport system. Mm-hmm. I love biking. And
you
I think
see so much more on a bike.
Yeah, but I think people are still... So, one, I think people either see it as taboo. I wouldn't say taboo, but, like, dangerous. Like, more
dangerous
than it actually is.
DC has gone a lot safer, because I...
All the bike lanes,
I mean,
have made biking a lot
exactly, cause
safer.
Exactly, because when you were still living in Arlington, Clarendon, I used to also biking to DC sometimes from your place.
Yeah.
And there's, like, nothing. And you can bike on the sidewalks even because no one knows the laws. And last time I was biking, there's so many extra lanes.
Yeah, it's nice. It's very nice. But also, like, some people don't think the public transit is... they think it's beneath them, essentially. And, you know, like, I think it's just a lot easier. Like, Chris and I only use the car if we have to go down to the parents or if we have to go to a place that's essentially metro inaccessible.
Yeah.
And it saves us, like, so having a car is actually more of a cost to us right now than it is any kind of benefit for the, you know, like, it doesn't provide a whole lot of benefit for the value of maintaining it. And
but I do think that that's also, I think in the U.S. we have these, not just in the U.S., I think in general, people of maybe not, like, people in our weird transitory generation, because I feel like the reason why our generation is very different from our parents is because of the boom in technology.
Right.
Has really changed our lives very rapidly, right? I feel like there's that traditional path, right? You get a job, you get married, you get a house, you have a kid. And, I mean, you can also track your finances in that way, right? Because these are all things that take money. But I think a part of that is also, like, getting a car.
Yeah.
And I don't think very many Americans... Maybe, unless you grew up in the city, because I know some New Yorkers who do not know how to drive, right, and have never been in a car kind of thing. Like, I think many Americans, you know, we tie our, like, our idea of success and financial health to being able to reach these financial goals. Whether or not they actually fit our lifestyles, that's a different matter, right?
Yeah. Okay, so I have a deck of questions, but I have chosen one for this episode because the deck is all metaphorical, really.
As one would expect from your banking institution. Yes. Shout out to Charles Schwab. They've been a great banking institution, just saying.
How comfortable are you with haggling and negotiating?
Terrible. I am terrible at it.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean by terrible?
Explain. I feel... So when I was, for instance, in Morocco, because I know already they have a culture for haggling.
Right.
I kind of feel like the price that you see is the, you know, that says something about the value of the item that you're buying. I'm not used to this idea that it's already marked up because they expect you to bring it down, right?
Yeah.
So when I was in Morocco, knowing that they expect you to haggle, but not really knowing how to do it myself,
right?
I just told them if they would ask where I'm from, I would tell them that I'm Filipino instead of American.
Oh, I see.
And when they go, oh, you speak English so well. Yes, that's why they hired me to watch their children. This is all from TV.
What does that have to do with haggling?
Because they wouldn't give me the American price or the Western European price. They would think, oh, she's one of those Filipinas that they hire, like, as a nanny or as a maid. I see,
so they feel sorry for you.
They would not assume that I have a lot of money.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Or like on Poshmark, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the app.
No.
It's like thrift shopping except online.
Huh.
And it's generally catered towards like designer items, but you have non-designer items as well.
Right.
Unless the people mark that they're doing the final price or whatever.
Right.
That's the final price. You're expected to haggle.
Online.
You can make an offer.
Oh, okay.
And I'm always like, well, how much do I offer? If I do like 50%, will they get offended and say like, hey, but this is like a Gucci bag. What are you?
But isn't that the whole point of haggling?
That is, but how low do you go, right? Because a part of it is also saying how much is it worth?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
And if someone says the original price is $298, I want $200, and you say, no, I'm going to give you $75.
Interesting.
For something that's in good condition, then what?
Well, let's take this out of haggling. Have you ever negotiated your salary before?
Yeah.
You have?
I have.
And how was that experience?
I felt like I was kind of pulling teeth. Right?
In what way?
So, you know, when I moved, I had this... Because when I was moving, I wasn't moving jobs. I was just moving with my boss and relocating.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her...
Yeah, and you were going from Philly to New York.
Yeah, Philly to New York. So a substantial difference in the price. Yeah. Even if I had chosen to live in the suburbs.
Right.
Right? So I looked up the prices of living in that area. I looked up the typical salary for the same thing that I had. I looked up the salary range because there we were working for a state university. So legally, they can only give me so much.
Right.
right? And I went to my boss and I was just like, hey, you know, since we're moving, I think that I should make more. And I think at this point, unless, you know, you're unhappy with my work or there's something that you feel like I need to work on, which we just haven't discussed, I feel like I've proven that I can do my job, that I can do it well, and I should get this much.
Yeah. What was her reaction?
Her reaction, because in academia, it's a bit strange. I get paid out of her grants.
Oh, I see. So she has to be a little bit stingy about it.
Exactly. And especially yeah. She's a young professor. She didn't really want to give as much. Her reaction is just like, I can meet you, like, I can do this for you, but I don't, you know, like, I've argued for you when I argued for myself. So I cannot promise too much.
I argued for you when I argued for myself?
So oh, when she was arguing for her salary, she computed me and my coworker into that situation.
In addition to a raise?
So, in addition to whatever she was...
Oh, I see. For you to keep your jobs, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's also kind of... It also kind of felt like, oh, you should have asked for this earlier, but I didn't find out until the end, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how could I have argued for it earlier?
Right.
She did give because she saw... I made the point, like, hey, this is how much it is, and I've been working here. I now have experience, and you know... the type of work that I can do, especially since I had a lot of autonomy in that job.
Right.
She did tell me not to tell my other coworker though, and I'm like, screw that.
Yeah. Oh, you told Rami?
Of course.
Oh.
Of course.
Sorry, I didn't mean to use his name, but I guess.
I felt like so even though we have different degrees and different backgrounds, so her reasoning, he's leaving soon, and you know, as women, we get paid less anyway. My reasoning was, he also does a great job.
Yeah.
And he's been working for you for longer than I have.
It goes back to this whole taboo of not being able to talk about your salary or even just your finances openly. For employers, it benefits them. Like in the case of your boss,
they don't have to pay us equally.
Exactly, they don't have to. Like, you were asking for a raise, you didn't want your coworker to ask for a raise as well.
Exactly,
you know, they would not benefit her because it would be pulling from her grant, and so it helps for them people in positions of power, but like even in this case, to keep that sort of stuff hidden.
Exactly.
When in actuality, for people like who are kind of the worker bees in this situation, it helps to have that transparency. That way you can negotiate.
Yeah, and then you see, because I feel like there's this disparity. Like women tend to undervalue their skills,
mm-hmm.
but then you can like. I've been working with this guy for a year. I can make some comparison on what I'm capable of, what he's capable of.
Right. And
see how much it's worth.
And you, if you and him were doing the same job, doing it at the same quality, you should be, like, arguably, like, making the same amount of money.
So like, my thing was he should actually be making slightly more because he's been working for her longer than I have. So he has more experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I have haggled for that, for a salary.
Yeah. And I think negotiating is a skill that everyone should have.
To be able to negotiate. I mean,
I think you have to, like, going back to, like, the worth of something, you have to be able to realize what the worth of
that item is.
In terms of salary, like how much you are worth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then be able to kind of say, no, like you're charging weight. I should be making more because of X.
Yeah.
And then continually reassessing and doing that sort of evaluation on yourself.
Yeah. I will say, though, that it does require a lot of research beforehand.
Right. And I think people are too scared because... It's terrifying. It's terrifying to advocate for yourself.
Yeah, and I think if you're rejected, it kind of feels like, oh, so I'm not actually worth this much.
Right, right. Yeah. And it puts you in a... Part of it is, like, I think it will require a change that maybe you're not prepared for.
Yeah, and I think it's also, like, a slight reframing. So when I went into this situation, I thought, okay, so she's bringing us with her. She's starting a new lab.
Yeah.
Right? And... But because she hasn't been there for the past few months, really, and at one point she'd come back from a month-long vacation.
Yeah.
She walks in and she says, oh my God, you guys are, you know, you're still running things. The lab hasn't burned down. I'm just your cash cow. Which is true. Like, we ran the lab.
Yeah.
And it was the realization going into this negotiation that without me, she can't do her job.
Right.
And I think it's a realization that I had, and I felt especially more than my coworker because he was leaving to go to grad school soon.
Right.
Really, without me, she cannot do her job.
Right. Right.
So I had more leverage in that sense.
Right. Yeah, and I think people are scared to make use of leverage that they have.
Yeah.
Right. Because it leads to change, it leads to confrontation, it leads to these things. But in reality, it's just making sure that you advocate for yourself and that you are getting paid what you are worth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I think everyone should learn to negotiate.
Yeah.
I actually...
How are you with haggling, though?
I love it.
Really?
I love it.
Wait, for items or for what?
For both.
Okay.
I love coming up with, like, strategies for negotiation and being okay. Like, okay, well, listen, I've been a loyal customer for this many years.
Yeah.
I deserve this. Like I really want to stay with you guys. I really deserve this. And shopping around and, like, coming back with research and being... my first kind of taste of it, like, I've done it with salaries before, but, like, my first taste of it was when I bought my new car, or it wasn't even new, it was a used car.
Yeah.
But I had done, Jeep. No, the Jeep. So that's an interesting thing, because, you think that, our dad is...
He's not really good at haggling.
He's so bad at it, but he likes to make this kind of show of it.
Yeah.
And I remember when we bought the Jeep, actually, I remember that he asked to see the Carfax. He wanted to see, like, what the car history was for this particular car.
Yeah.
And I remember from where I was sitting, watching the car dealership, the car dealer, kind of type into his car, pretend to, like, type something into the Carfax website, and say, well, sorry, it's not working. Like, but I can promise you something's... And it's like...
That's
I tried to pull him aside, and I was like, no, that's not, like, he didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Like, it was fake. Like, he didn't even try to log in. He just went to the Carfax website. Like, but my dad took him at face value and just, like, accepted the car. And I remember, like, driving that car for maybe, like, 2 or 3 years, remembering that there was a weird smell of rotten milk. Like, yes. Yeah, that was, like, my first, I mean, like, truly my first, like, sense of what it meant to negotiate.
Yeah.
And it was a really bad one.
Well, I think, it's funny because it also ties into this idea of wealth that we were speaking of before.
Yeah.
Because I know my mom pointed out, because when you go to the Philippines, you really see some people who are great at haggling, great at negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
Auntie Mooney, like our father's sister, she's terrible at it as well. And I feel like having grown up with the money that they had, they never had to negotiate.
Right.
They can afford to pay things at face value, even if that item is not worth that much.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so when I got my next car after the Jeep, I did my research. Mm-hmm. I looked around and I knew, not necessarily like maybe the kind of car that I wanted, but I knew like the general sense of what I wanted.
Yeah.
And how much I wanted to pay for a car.
Yeah.
And so I did my research. And I looked around, and I remember, like, coming into these car dealerships and, like, negotiating, like, saying, no, I'm not going to pay this much for what you're offering. It's got this dent here. It's got this, and, like, all these things are wrong with
wrong.
It. And I'll pay this much.
Yeah.
And, like, it got to the point where, you know, like, they do have all these kind of weird pressure tactics. Like, they'll write on a pad of paper trying to convince you that the math is right. But, you know, like, you're dealing with an engineer here. I'm like, well... That's cool that you know how to do math on paper and upside down, but I need to know, like, I need to kind of work the math out myself first before I'm comfortable with what you're saying to me.
Yeah.
And so that tactic didn't work. So they brought out their manager, and the manager was like, listen, this is, like, the absolute lowest I can give you. Like, this car is not worth that much. I went to the other place and got this deal. And, you know, like, I love the whole, almost like the drama of it, like the dramatics of it, and being able to kind of just, like, stand up, walk away, and say, sorry. No.
I mean, it's
almost like a position of power.
It kind of is, right? Because they're the ones who stand to lose something, right?
Yeah. They lose your business.
Yeah, exactly. When I was in Turkey, I was looking up this stuff, right? Because, you know, like, everyone wants... That's, like, one of the big things you do in Istanbul is you go to the Grand Bazaar.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go, you really need to be able to negotiate. Because I think especially just the mix of Turkish hospitality and... The tactics that they use can be disarming.
Yeah.
Right? Because, I mean, if you walk into some place and a Turkish person offers you tea, it means nothing. They are just offering you tea because that is the that's their thing.
Yeah.
Right? But they'll be grabbing at you. They'll come to my store. I can give you this discount, blah, blah, blah. You know, oh, it's just my last. So I was going specifically for an elephant for mom, right?
Yeah.
And this, you know, like so many people had the exact same elephant with like, yeah. I personally didn't like it because it was kind of derpy looking, not because I thought anything of it. But I saw it in two different stores, and I'm like, oh, so this is mass-produced. This is not coming from the same person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not worth this amount because probably if it's mass-produced, it's just made in China, right? And they're like, no, it's my last one, good-selling, lucky elephant, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, eh.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to go, so there's kind of, like, that theatrics to it.
Yeah, there is.
Especially with those Turkish sellers, they're just like, oh, I guess, you know, it's like the end of the day. I guess I don't need that elephant, you know?
You have to, come prepared. You have to, know what game they're playing.
Exactly. And the thing is, I guess a part of it is you need to be able to say, okay, no, I'm going to go elsewhere.
Yeah, you have to know where to say, like, well, this isn't worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what happens when you make a mistake? Because with that one, you know, most of the elephants I saw, they're like, ah. But I saw one elephant, which was a decent price.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it anywhere else in the market, right? The ones that I saw in the market, I even later saw in the airport.
Yeah.
Right? Which in Morocco, that's actually something they tell you to do if you want to go out and about, especially like to get to the tagines, is to go to the airport stores first to see what those are priced at.
Oh, do they haggle at the airport stores?
No.
Okay.
They don't haggle. That's why.
Yeah, I see. And then you can see what the value is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you go to the airport store, you see the value, and then you know when you're overpaying in the markets.
Yeah.
But they had an elephant there, which I didn't see anywhere else. That one, I think, was truly handmade.
Yeah.
And because I didn't know, and I was asking my friend, is this typical of, like... Because I wanted really something very typical of Ottoman or Turkish pottery.
Yeah.
I was just like... Because I'm not familiar with the wares, I thought, oh, I can walk away. I can always come back.
Yeah.
This is a lie. You can never, you're never going to be able to find the same store again in the Grand Bazaar. So.
Oh, really?
It's like a maze.
Oh.
It's like a maze. It's like, I've never.
You should have marked it with like a geo tag or
he
something.
He gave me a, the business card actually includes the map.
Yeah.
And exactly where to find them. But the thing is, on the, you know, like, there's a little square of the Grand Bazaar. They don't mark any of the streets. And they don't mark north, south, east, west.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, this tells me nothing. So, yeah, you need to know the quality of the wares.
So, last question before we close out. What have you learned today? Any new financial tips, tricks? Things, lessons?
No, I learned nothing from listening to this.
Wow. Not even our conversations today?
No, I mean, they've been nice conversations.
But you've learned nothing new?
Yeah. Wow. It's kind of like reinforcing things I've already learned. Like taking a philosophy class.
What does that have to do with anything?
Have you ever taken a philosophy course?
No.
Really? You weren't required to take one in university?
I feel like I took a religion course on Buddhism, but that's it. I guess, if you think religion is philosophy, then yes.
Maybe.
Perhaps I did.
I took one on the nature of scientific revolutions.
Hmm.
And it kind of felt like, you know, you never stop to think about this stuff. But if you had, yes, this is exactly what I would have said too.
Oh.
Maybe that's kind of big-headed.
Is that how you feel about finance?
Is that no, it's how saying? I feel about this conversation.
Oh, I see. And also finance.
Yes. I mean, I think it's nice to have the conversation because you're right. People don't generally talk about it.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, no, it's just, I think, I feel like there's no reason not to, really.
No.
I mean, I feel like if you're going to be sensitive, that's the only reason why I would probably shy away from it.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, hurt your feelings or make you feel uncomfortable about any kind of topic, but.
Yeah.
Really, there's no reason to, like, I'm not going to judge you.
No, but this is also very cultural as well. In the Netherlands, it's not as taboo to talk about how much you make or what things like that.
Part of it is, I think, we are very capitalist here.
The Dutch are way more capitalist.
Yes, but they also have a lot of socialist nets.
Things, yeah, they do, yeah.
Yeah, whereas, you know, like, there really aren't the same sort of, safety nets that that they have over here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think that you risk a lot and you fall harder.
Yeah. But at the same time, you there's always the possibility that you climb higher.
Yeah.
And I think that's the risk that you take in our version of capitalism, I guess.
You think? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean...
Because I think that what helps the wealthy stay wealthy is that they have the ability to diversify their assets.
Yes.
You are not just pouring all your money into one... Like, in bringing it back full circle, mm-hmm. that they're able to put some of their money into other
things.
Income streams.
Yes, whereas other people are not.
Well, yeah, if you are constrained on how much you can put on anything, then you're going to have a harder time.
So, I mean, it's interesting because in the Netherlands, there are actually a whole lot of tax breaks if you choose, for instance, to start a business. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of encouragement to go that route, mm-hmm. I guess, in that sense. But I wouldn't say that that's a typical route for most people in the Netherlands. And I'm coming from a school that's known for their entrepreneurship, you know? So I think if a lot of people I knew were starting businesses, it's because the school encouraged it and we were in this sort of a bubble.
I see.
I don't think it's something that was the norm, right?
Yeah.
And I think a part of it is, you know, you're right, the rich have the ability to diversify their assets. But I think they're also taught that.
Yeah.
You know, or if they're not taught that, they see that their parents have it. They see when they inherit wealth, it comes from this and this.
Well, again, full circle, like, it's because, they were taught that at some point in their
lives.
Or
they see it, you know.
Right, and whereas if you are not, if you're coming from parents that only know...
They don't have apples in the trees, as
or
the
cult
leader said.
Or, like, the only personal finance tip that they can give you is, like, pay off all your credit card loans or debts. Yeah, like what else? How else are you going to understand where your money should or can go?
Yeah. I was speaking at one point to a colleague who's Iranian. Well, I was speaking with a Brazilian colleague who's very a very rational person, I guess is the way to put this. And he's not the type of person to put up with. I will do this because this is normally what happens, you know.
Yeah.
This is he questions everything, I guess, is it. Versus the Iranian girl who's very traditional.
Yeah.
And at one point he's talking about these passive streams of income and she goes, "No, that's just not how the world works."
Passive streams of income?
Yeah, like you don't get money for nothing.
Right.
You don't get money if you're not working for it.
Oh.
And I think that there are many people who think in that same way because that is not, you know, like the idea of putting your money in other places other than your 9-to-5 job.
Right.
I think...
What is the saying? There's no such thing as a free lunch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's also, I mean, it kind of also goes to the scientific revolutions, right? If this is the worldview that you've built, mm-hmm. which is based off of all of your other experiences, everything else other people have told you, if someone else offers you a piece of information that completely contradicts this view that you've built, what do you do? Do you get rid of it? How do you remold your worldview to fit that piece of information?
Yeah.
And when we were there talking about, you know, passive streams of income, doing more, you know, doing things on the side of the 9-to-5 and, you know, royalties, for instance, I think the idea of royalties is just like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, like, for this
girl. Yeah, the concept, yeah.
Yeah, she's just like, no, that's not how the world works. I'm like, clearly you have not seen The Lion Kid King.
Clearly you have not
seen, Lion King Kid.
You have not seen, like, how other people do their business and are getting rich.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. That's just it. I think most people are not introduced to these way that other people make money. So when you tell them this, it's just like, that's weird. Why would you lazy person, you know, like, why would you, that's just not how it works.
Yeah, but it's not that you're being lazy. It's just that you have to diversify your train of thought, really.
Yeah, it's like you don't want to put all of your eggs into one basket.
Yeah. So that's the lesson for today, folks.
Don't put all of your eggs into one basket.
Financial health. Right. No. Passive income.
Huh.
Even the cults are teaching it, so why not? So take it from us.
Pump, pump, pump.
That's it for our show, folks. I'm your host, Francis Tan. Follow us on our Instagram at hkef.productions. We post every other week. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. And until next time, the best ship to sail on is friendship.